The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk. Coming up,
I feel that my confidential sources have been protected, that I can hold my head up high and say that I've stood up for principle, and I've also won on that. And now it's a question of refining exactly what should be given of the police.
A victory for common sense, but at what cost? We speak to Shiv Malik, the journalist at the centre of the case where terrorism police demanded to see his sources. Also in the podcast, Arianna Huffington tells us about the expansion of the Huffington Post, and we get the lowdown on AP's demands for higher standards of blogging. Plus, Culture Secretary Andy Burnham warns against the creeping Americanisation of the British news. And
I think at the time we didn't think there was such a thing as libel on the internet, but turns out there is.
Celebrity gossip and libel. We hear from pop bitches Camilla Wright about the wicked whispers on the net. It's all coming up in this week's Media Talk from The Guardian. In the week, the former Sun editor, Kelvin McKenzie, backed down from his threat to run against David Davis. We have three of Media Talk's finest statesmen ready for public service. Emily Bell is The Guardian's Director of Digital Content, the Baroness of all things interweb, I think.
Having seen Arianna last night, perhaps Saint Arianna, I wouldn't dream. I could only dream of being a baronet, the queen of the internet. I'm a mere serf.
John Plunkett is radio correspondent for MediaGuardian.co.uk. I suppose you could be a peer of the realm in your pinstripes that you often wear.
Well, thanks, Matt. Yeah, I'm thinking of standing in against Davis if The Guardian will back me.
I don't think, if the Sun's not backing McKenzie, I don't think we're backing you. And ambassador of all the best bits of Americana, we're joined by this week by internet guru Jeff Jarvis. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, the rebel comes home.
Absolutely. Minister of Fun, Gareth McLean, will be joining us later to round up the week's television news. And we'll also be hearing from a real politician, the Culture Minister, Andy Burnham. But we're going to start this week with a bit of real news.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on Guardian.co.uk.
To the High Court and the case of journalist Shiv Malik. He's been fighting an order from Greater Manchester Police to hand over his notes relating to a book he's been writing about the ex-jihadi sympathiser Hassan Butt. Butt had been arrested and police were investigating him under the Terrorism Act. They'd issued Malik and other media organisations with a wide-ranging set of orders. Now, the court hearing decided that the order was right in principle, but it said the terms were drawn too broadly. Shiv now faces a new hearing next week, and he came into the studio earlier.
Well, I think the most important part about it all was that the courts have recognised and, again, sort of instantiated in principle that journalists do have confidential sources, and despite how seemingly great the danger or the importance in this field, the field of terrorism, journalists have a right to protect those confidential sources from even the police.
But the other side of the same coin is that the High Court has also accepted, in principle, that the police can seize reporters' notes.
Yes, I don't think they were ever going to sort of come down in favour of there never being a production order power, because Parliament's already got that power down. It's been wrangled around for a long, long time. So it's a question of how these things are framed. They basically deny the police the powers to go on fishing expeditions, especially when it comes to terrorism.
So your complaint was that the original order by the police was too wide-ranging. They wanted anything that you had, was it?
Yes, that it was too wide-ranging. I mean, obviously, unfortunately, I can't talk about exactly what they wanted. It's under legal advice. I'm not allowed to talk about that. But I can say that, obviously, I'm writing a book. And given that, there's a lot of stuff that you need to write one. And they came in, essentially, and sort of wrote up an exhaustive list. And the court said, well, look, that's just not good enough. You can't just have and take what you want. You have to be a bit more precise. And in this case, I think we've really narrowed down exactly. Well, the High Court has said, look, you've got confidential sources, that's fine. But anything that's not confidential, that should be able to be given over.
So are you comfortable then with the order that's been made? Do you feel that your confidential sources are protected and that in the future people will still talk to you?
Yes, I feel that my confidential sources have been protected, that I can hold my head up high and say that I've stood up for principle, and I've also won on that. And now it's a question of refining exactly what should be given of the police. It's not clear what that will be.
Because presumably they'll have to go back to the lower court to reapply for an order.
Well, I think the suggestion is that instead of going and starting the process again, I think we're going to hammer this out between our legal representatives and go back to the High Court and something we worked out there. Yes.
Okay. Well, these sorts of stories are always very difficult to explain to a wider audience, because the general public would probably come down in favour of the police. They might think that it's reasonable in the course of a terrorism investigation that the police should have access to all the material that they need to keep the public safe. Would you agree with that, albeit on a limited scale?
There is a debate between security and civil liberties and the rights of the journalistic community. And I recognise that debate. But however, it's interesting that the judges have themselves said, well, look, there should be other avenues and of information for the public, right? So in this field of terrorism, it's largely dominated by the police, the security service and the government as to what's known. And so any work that journalists do in this field is especially important. And the other point to that is that I always argue that the police have witness protection schemes. We don't ask them to give up their witnesses after, say, a couple of years or whatever. They say, no, it's over now, because witnesses would never return back to them. And so in the same way, journalists need to protect their confidential sources in that exact manner.
Tell me a bit about the experience that you had. What happened? Did the police phone you up or come knocking at your door, or how did it all start?
Well, this was the interesting thing. They really genuinely turned up at my door at 10 to 8, completely out of the blue. I didn't expect it. In fact, I was still in my boxer shorts, embarrassing, when I answered the door.
I should say that Shiv is in a smart suit now. Here,
yes,
in the podcast.
I don't normally traverse London in half naked. No. In typical sort of British fashion, after a couple of hours, I invited them back in for tea, and I apologising for not having enough biscuits, and them apologising for trampling on my civil liberties. But they were in some parts threatening. Then, I mean, I think it's difficult for any freelance journalist without the support of institutions such as the Guardian or the NUJ, you know, directly behind them. It's difficult to say, well, yes, I'm going to stand for principle, unless you know exactly what you're doing. And thankfully, I did have that support, and so I told them.
Because we should explain, you are a freelance journalist. You're not attached to any particular organisation. You ended up getting the support, I understand, of the NUJ, is that right?
Of the NUJ and the Sunday Times, financially. So, I mean, you know, it's been pretty expensive. Going to the High Court is expensive business anyway. And I think the costs are in something of £100,000. But I've also had the support of many other organisations and journalists, such as Martin Bright, who's been through similar things like this in the past and gave me his experience. It's absolutely vital to have this.
Shiv Malik there. This is interesting, Emily Bell, isn't it? Because we've come round this particular roundabout a few times before, and it does seem increasingly now that the police are looking to journalists to get whatever information that they can out of them. And we're just going to accept, and it does seem that the High Court have accepted, that some information will be handed over, and the debate is only going to be about where the restrictions are drawn.
Well, I think it was ever thus, to some extent, there has always been this tension between right to protect sources. I mean, you know, it has to be said that it's hard to imagine having a sort of fully functioning democracy in a world where you can't, as it were, sort of, you know, have confidentiality between a reporter and sources. I think it's very troubling that when you get to a point where the police can step over a line, as Shiv was saying in the interview, on fishing expeditions, which is essentially saying, well, we're not quite sure what it is we're looking for, but if we take everything, we might find something, you know, of interest, as opposed to a specific piece of supporting evidence. So I think, you know, from that point of view, it is going to be about where you draw the line. I think that, you know, this is part of obviously a much wider piece about civil liberties and the rules which are sort of redrawn either through the courts or through Parliament at a time when you can wave a flag, call it, you know, security. I mean, it's interesting, it sort of happens in other areas as well, like, you know, with energy security, you can do almost anything these days with planning laws if you say, but we have to run an oil pipeline over here. And I think it's sort of, there's something very profoundly troubling about it, actually. But it's not new. I mean, that's the important thing, is that, sort of, you know, it often happened in the 70s around sort of the Northern Irish Troubles, etc. There was a lot of kind of pressure there for people to disclose their sources, etc.
And it's also slightly alarming and troubling that John Plunkett, the police can just knock your door a quarter to eight in the morning and find you in your boxer shorts.
That's right. That's a pleasant surprise, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think it's quite tricky because presumably until the police know exactly what Shiv Malik's got, they don't know what to ask for. So it's a kind of chicken and egg situation. It's going to be interesting. I guess it all depends on what happens next as to how much this is a victory for common sense, as Shiv said.
Jeff Jarvis, what do you make about this from an American point of view? Because you guys have the First Amendment, which gives quite a lot of protection to journalists.
But we don't have a federal shield law, right, that protects journalist sources at that level. And the other problems around that are also that Judy Mill of the New York Times kind of gave shielding a bad name when she shielded information she frankly shouldn't have regarding Cheney and Company. The other issue that's coming up all the time now is those states that do have shield laws, who's a journalist now? We all are, and that complicates things. So though we'll get a federal shield law after January and the new president, it still gets only more complicated.
Okay. Well, that's something we can carry on discussing. The citizen journalism thing is we're going to discuss that a bit later on. And the story of Shiv Malik we'll be following on mediaguardian.co.uk. Arianna Huffington is undoubtedly one of the biggest stars of the blogosphere, apart from, of course, your good self, Jeff Jarvis here. The ex-wife of millionaire Republican politician Michael Huffington. She's a high-profile political columnist, broadcaster. Of course, she's editor-in-chief and founder of the community news, politics and comment site, The Huffington Post. She's written about a dozen books on the state of American politics, and her latest work is called The Right is Wrong, which has the marvellous subtitle, How the Lunatic Fringe Hijacked America, Shredded the Constitution, and Made Us All Less Safe, and What You Need to Know to End the Madness. Suffice to say that John McCain will not be getting a vote come November. Well, Arianna was in London this week. She was being interviewed, actually, by The Guardian's editor, Alan Rusbridger, part of our series of talks and seminars about the future of journalism, all of which we're covering on mediaguardian.co.uk. Now, in that interview with Alan, she revealed that The Huffington Post will be expanding into local news across the US, hiring reporters, opening a new site for Chicago, in part, she said, to provide an antidote to the mainstream media. I caught up with her after her talk to find out more.
The main problem has been the willingness of many in the mainstream media to sell their independence for access. And I give examples among the sort of icons of American journalism, including Bob Woodward. The other problem is the mainstream media's ADD, you know, their attention deficit disorder. So major stories would often die on the front pages of the New York Times, like recently the story about the Pentagon military analysts being briefed and by the Pentagon and then basically selling propaganda to the American people, which would have died were it not for the blogosphere pursuing it. And the other problem is the in pursuit of balance, presenting both sides to every story, very often the mainstream media miss the pursuit of truth.
And so what do you hope that you can do? Because you're becoming much more influential, you're hiring reporters, you're expanding around the world. Aren't you just in danger yourself of taking on some of those problems that you criticize?
Absolutely, because that's why I call these human problems inherent in human nature, especially the problem of access. And so it is our responsibility to guard against that. And it requires vigilance. And as we are offered more and more access, we have to make sure that we are very careful about that.
So how do you see your role as one of the leading sources of online news and comment in the United States? Is it as an antidote to the problems in the US media or an alternative? What is your mission statement?
I think all of the above. An antidote, an alternative, and as we're moving towards more and more reporting, a more powerful alternative, but also a way that we are presenting a kind of hybrid model where we take the best of traditional journalism, fact-checking, accuracy, fairness, and bring it together with the best of online media, intimacy, passion, accessibility, 24/7 updating, and a belief that there is truth and it is our job, however incompletely, to ferret it out.
And can you make any money from this venture?
Yes, absolutely. Our business model is entirely advertising supported, and we are...
But you're heading for a massive advertising crash, aren't you?
Well, let's see what happens. You know, the advertising is definitely moving online, so we may find that online media are less affected than mainstream media.
Since you've been in the United Kingdom, your main experience of the British media, I guess, was an interview with Jeremy Paxman on Newsnight. How did you find that?
Well, I found it interesting that he really saw mainstream media as somehow being immune from the problems of inaccuracy and fact-checking. And, you know, he said, well, you know, you correct things if there are mistakes, but it's already appeared. Well, it's already appeared in the New York Times, too, with disastrous consequences when it comes to the reporting in the lead-up to the war.
You're not a traditional journalist. You've done many things in your life. What prompted you to give up what went before and launch this sort of crusade against the evils of the mainstream media?
It's the most exciting thing I've done. It brings together everything I love, you know, writing, reporting, getting my friends to do things like write for free. And in the process, you know, being part of the debate in the most exciting election in American politics that I've been part of.
Arianna Huffington, Jeff Jarvis, she's a very, very unlikely revolutionary, isn't she?
Well, we have Arianna and Craig Newmark will change journalism in America. That's the odd couple.
Yeah. What do you make of her? I mean, she's not a famous name in Britain at all, except perhaps in the online community, but she's been a very influential voice in this campaign, hasn't she? Particularly because of one of her journalists, in inverted commas.
I was among those who laughed when she sat down at the keyboard, and I was wrong. She's really built something quite amazing in Huffington Post and is experimenting in ways that the ossified old media are not. So in this election, she and Jay Rosen of NYU created Off the Bus with hundreds of people who are not professionals who are following the election.
And they're not following it on the campaign buses. That's the reason for the title.
We don't go to the spin room.
Right.
And so one of them became rather infamous in the last few weeks, Mayhill Fowler, a 61-year-old woman who had never been a journalist, never written, but had the money to be able to follow Obama around and also was transparently an Obama supporter who had maxed out on her contributions to him. She's the person who was in a fundraising event with her tape recorder on when he talked about how middle Americans were bitter and clung to their guns and religion.
Oh, that was her.
That was her. And a few weeks later, she was on the rope line when Bill Clinton walked by, and she was going to hand him her business card and ask for an interview with his wife, but she dropped it, and instead, in the heat of the moment, she just blurted out and said, "What do you think of that hatchet job done by the former New York Times reporter Todd Purdom in Vanity Fair?" And Bill Clinton led off on a series of invectives that, you'd put on this podcast.
Yeah, go on, say it.
Scumbag.
Yeah.
And so there's much controversy in U.S. media about her.
Because those were two big stories, weren't they?
They were huge stories. They were arguably the biggest stories in this election came from this 61-year-old amateur.
And I have to say that I don't think it was widely known, certainly not over here. It wasn't widely known that they'd come from her.
Well, see, in the huge debate going on in American media, and I defend Fowler at this, but the argument of the professionals is she didn't follow our rules. And those rules are really to maintain the club and to maintain this idea of access, which is a deal to keep secrets with those in power.
So she didn't say to Bill Clinton, "I'm from the Huffington Post," and she didn't announce herself as a journalist, or she wasn't invited as a journalist to that fundraiser.
She does acknowledge that she should have said, "I'm from the Huffington Post," to Clinton, but she didn't. And you know what? So what? If I had been asking the question and said, "Oh, dram, I didn't say my name, but Emily's next to me," Emily can now tell the world.
Yeah.
And so it really doesn't matter. Life is public now.
This is really interesting. I mean, they're all beating themselves up, over the other side of the pond. Even the bloggers are saying that, "Oh God, she should have announced it." I don't know that she should have said who she
was. Well, okay,
have you got a big problem with it?
No, not at all. Actually, I think you know. She got stories that the mainstream media didn't, so the mainstream media's excuse is, well, it was just sneaky, and she did it by stealth. But actually, Arianna's point about access is absolutely to the point here. Mayhill Fowler doesn't mind if she burns her contacts. You know, it doesn't matter to her if she never gets back into a room with Obama, and it doesn't matter to her if Bill Clinton never speaks to her for the rest of his life.
Because there's always another Mayhill.
Yeah, exactly. And also, just because that's not what she does. It's not her profession. Now, for Arianna, the issue is, will Obama kind of play ball with her because of Mayhill? Will Clinton, you know, play ball with her because of Mayhill? She's saying, well, you know, I don't care. These are our terms of trade, if you like, with our sources. But I think it's very interesting. I mean, I think that if you turn the telescope round and say, supposing you weren't a journalist for the Huffington Post or on assignment. But supposing he had said that to you and you had your mobile phone running or your tape recorder on and you thought, my God, this is dynamite, and then post hoc you sold it to the Huffington Post, the New York Times, whatever. It's not, you know, it's... These are people are public figures in public spaces. You don't have to have a cordoned off area with a velvet rope around it with press to know that anything you say in those spaces is going to find its way to the outside world.
It seems to me, Jeff, that one of the problems is that we are too keen and eager, I guess, as journalists in all sorts of spheres, but even in our own sphere, of wanting to attach labels to people. So over here in one corner, we have the journalists. And then over here in another corner, we have these new people. They're called citizen journalists. And then presumably over there in the third corner, there's all the other people. And I don't think it's like that, is it? It's just we're all sort of similar people. And it just so happens that you and I have platforms.
Yes, and the truth is we're all witnesses. Hmm. Now, that's not reporting necessarily. That's not going and trying to find out something we don't know. But if something happens, every witness in the world is now equipped, if they don't live in a repressive regime or North Korea, to report it to the world. And that's the reality of where we are now. So they can perform acts of journalism. And I think it's a mistake to define journalism by who does it. Hmm. Instead, it's the act and whether or not that act of journalism is true.
And Jeff, going back to Arianna Huffington particularly and her plans that she's been talking about to expand, she's hiring reporters. Isn't this the worst thing that she could possibly do? Hire reporters and get into local news in Chicago.
Alan Rusbridger was basically saying last night, you know, why would you bother with them?
Yeah. They're very expensive.
But the interesting thing was that there's a demand for journalism because she said that her answer was it gets great traffic.
Right. Yeah.
And that's really good news, I think, for us to say that actual reporting has a marketplace.
Emily.
I think that Arianna Huffington is an extraordinarily inspirational in this field. And I think going back to Jeff's point, she was a laughingstock of the mainstream media and the blogosphere when she started the Huffington Post. They said it's a rich woman with a Rolodex, this will never work. What I think is really interesting, though, is that she's kind of doing that web thing of making it up as she goes along. Mm. And that's an incredibly liberating model. And this idea that, well, you can't, why are you hiring, and you're hiring one journalist, you can't cover a city with one journalist. And she said, well, we'll see. Mm. I think that this is kind of one of the things that inhibits a lot of traditional media for making progress because of conventions about how you do these things.
She's obviously got a damn good Rolodex, has to be said. Jeff, I wanted to stick with the internet, but just move on a bit to talk about the Associated Press. Now, the AP has started getting a bit tough with bloggers in particular, haven't they? You as well.
Well, no, I'm being tough with them.
You've been tough with them.
They sent cease and desist letters from lawyers to a blogger recently, ordering them to take down excerpts from the AP that were between 33 and 79 words long. The fair use and fair comment doctrines in American law do not define a number of words you may use because it depends on what you need to make your comment. So the AP sent this. The bloggers, including me, just came up at arms. Hmm. And my headline was FUAP. FU stands for fair use.
Right.
And there's been quite a fight back and forth. This case is what it is. What it shows is a clash of media models. You have the old model, which is a content economy, clashing with the new model, which is a link economy. And the old model, information is a commodity now. It's not really where you have a special value. It travels out there. The only way you can exploit your value of what you've created is by getting links. And the AP doesn't understand that. It doesn't in part because it can't really be a consumer product because it has members who own it, who are the newspapers and clients, and they can't compete with those clients. Nonetheless, the AP is now stuck in Brigadoon and can't get out. And so they're fighting and not knowing whom to fight. At the same time, newspapers are fighting back. They say it's too expensive. All the newspapers, most of the newspapers in Ohio, are now trading original stories among themselves. Rather than having stories go through the mill of the AP where they rewrote it and took away the identity of the writing and the link to the original, now we have the original journalism popping up all over Ohio, which I think is a wonderful thing.
Isn't it fair, though, Emily, that the AP should seek to, you know, protect the value of their own journalism, which is, after all, their marketplace?
Well, it's very difficult, but it's very difficult, isn't it? Because if you are essentially a wire organisation like the AP, there's this idea that, you know, you are, hang on a second, you're stealing AP's news. I'm beg your pardon, whose news is this again? Is this an event that AP have created or just their report on it at a particular time? And, you know, Jeff is right that actually, you know, kind of what AP can't do is protect themselves, you know, above and beyond the law as it exists at the moment. And you can see a kind of panic in their eyes, if you like, the very fact that they've gone after the Drudge Retort, was it, which is a sort of a left-wing version of the Drudge Report. It was a bad target, poor thing to pick, wrong battle, wrong time. But it does highlight a real problem for things like the wire services, which is, do you carry on trying to monetize this sort of B2B commodity, or do you actually say, well, we're just going to go straight to the consumer market?
As Reuters
is trying to do. And actually PA, interestingly now, runs off, I think, is it PA that started to run off Google News in some areas?
This is the Press Association, which is the UK wire
which
service.
Is very interesting, because as soon as it starts to run off the front of Google News, you think, well, hang on a second, we're paying for that as customers.
We, the Guardian, you're talking about?
Or we collectively as the press, you know, any other customer that wants, you know, kind of wants it's going through a sort of a, I mean, I think it's tough because you have to change your model, and Reuters are trying, and I think AP are probably
a big business, big old fashioned business like the AP trying to struggle with the realities of the new age.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think. As Jeff described it, as the kind of link community where everyone links to everyone else's news. I think the issue is that there has to be one organisation that's prepared to put the resources in to actually do the legwork to kind of get the content and the news in the first place. And say if AP, you know, decides to pull back from that, who does it? Is it the kind of network of small individual journalists who come together and generate the news that way? Or will there no longer be a great big organisation like AP doing it?
What do you think? Is, you know, are the days of the big old agencies like the Press Association, Reuters and AFP and all those people, is there still going to be a role for those sorts of organisations in the new networked world that you talk about?
Reuters, I think, is a financial information company, and that's what they've made themselves with Thomson, so that's why they did it. We now see exactly why. I now see a point, and I don't want this world. I want the AP to be there to do the stories no one else is doing, so we make sure things get covered. I don't see the business model for them at all. And papers, meanwhile, cannot afford them. The Cleveland Plain Dealer in Ohio spends $1 million a year on the AP. If they go very, very local, they'll get their content from their network and other papers. They can ignore national and international. They don't have to deliver the world anymore. I say in my blog, my obnoxious PowerPoint line is, do what you do best and link to the rest. Mm. And that's what newspapers, local papers, are going to turn into. And papers like The Guardian have already become a platform for the voice of The Guardian, more than obviously for just breaking news. And the breaking news, The Guardian links to too. So Do you really need this mill to put content through? I only think it this week, but I think it could actually die.
Okay. Well, you can hear the full, going back to Arianna Huffington, you can hear the full audio of Alan Rusbridge's interview with her at mediaguardian.co.uk. There will be a video, very excitingly, in the new world now. We've filmed it. And when we get around to editing it, we'll put that up too. I'm Matt Wells, you're listening to Media Talk. Still to come, we hear from Pop Bitch's Camilla Wright and discuss showbiz, celebrity and libel, plus the latest on the race to succeed Jenny Abramsky at the top of BBC Radio. But first, if you were listening in last week and just exactly what were you doing if you weren't, you'll have heard Maggie Brown getting very excited about a talk she'd been to given by the new Culture Secretary, Andy Burnham. I think she was quite charmed, actually, Emily, by Andy Burnham.
Swoon. He's hot.
Not that hot.
No. I was sorry, that was me channeling Maggie.
This week, goodness me, what a thought. This week, Burnham was continuing his charm offensive. He gave a speech to the Broadcasting Press Guild, and he outlined the direction of his thinking, particularly in relation to ITV.
I feel strongly that ITV has, in the same way that print media going to the internet carry forward a kind of a, its past is important, is what I'm saying. And that might sound, again, old-fashioned, but I think the past is important in this context. ITV's DNA is in the region's regional production. That is what, like it or not, you know, those annoying people, the viewers, kind of say they quite like. They say they quite like regional news. And it may be inconvenient for some people that people like regional news, but they do.
Sticking with ITV, Burnham went on to talk about their regional production output.
I find it very disappointing indeed that ITV have now missed, for the second year on the run, their regional production quota, because there's a two-way, you know, these are legal requirements, and, you know, we have to move forward where, you know, these things are not negotiable to be kind of brushed away. They are important legal requirements that, you know, not been met. And it does make me question, you know, whether or not enough attention is being paid to these issues.
And then, amongst much clinking of tea and coffee cups, the Culture Secretary said how he was entirely against a UK version of Fox News appearing on British screens.
I've said, you know, that I would oppose what I would call the Americanisation of British television news. I don't think people want it. I think Ofcom research tells you that people are looking to TV for trusted, impartial news. That's what it's telling us. They're going to TV more, not less.
Now, we've already talked quite a lot about the Americanisation of the news on the podcast, so I was turning back to what he was saying about ITV. John Plunkett, it's very interesting, isn't it? Because it sounds like he sounds very different from his predecessor, James Purnell, who was something of a free marketeer. You got the feeling that Purnell was something of a free marketeer. With Burnham, you know, he sounds, obviously with his accent, he sounds rooted in the North, and it sounds like, yep, he's brought those values to the job. It's really interesting.
Yeah, he's not Mr. Metropolitan, is he?
No.
Yeah. And I think it's probably just the leg up that Michael Grade and ITV need, being told to reinforce their commitment to regional news and regional programming. So so the next year's got off to a good start, yes.
Emily, it's very interesting for ITV because their response whenever they're in trouble is usually to get some sort of regulatory relief from whatever it is they're struggling with at that particular moment. And usually, it has to be said, particularly under Charles Allen, they got it, didn't they? But it looks like he's wanting a quid pro quo.
Well, talk about mixed messages. I mean, it's a pretty rainy day when I feel sorry for ITV, but you've actually had a regulatory environment which has said we completely recognise that the market is changing to such an extent that people cannot be held to their licence remits, which is something that actually I think is wrong. But so you get in the tail end of that, you've got Andy Burnham coming in and saying, no, you're absolutely right, you should be held to your remit, you know, and don't forget ITV have been allowed to drop their commitment to children's programming on sort of ITV1. They've been allowed to roll back from the regionality of their remit. I can hear clip clop and the thunk, lock, clip clop, clip clop, clip clop. Surely this horse is a long way down the road by now.
I was trying to figure out what it was.
What's she talking about? It's like radio charades again, from channeling Maggie Brown to channeling Humphrey Littleton. It's just, I think, and last week, obviously, sort of Andy Burnham was saying, I don't really like the idea of product placement. You know, another kind of idea knocked on the head. I like the idea of regulating a watershed on the internet.
Yes.
Which,
I asked him about that at this lunch, actually. And you know, cause I said to him, you surely can't be saying that you can transfer the same requirements and expectations that you had of broadcasters onto the internet. And he appeared to say that he did.
Oh, yeah, no, I think if you read the text of his speech, it's very obvious that he thinks that we should apply the same standards. But what does that mean? I mean, I think these are all sort of very kind of moving words. What does it mean that ITV have missed? He's disappointed that ITV have missed their regional production quota for the second year in a row. Is he going to take their licence away? Is he going to put pressure on Ofcom to take their licence away? Are they going to be fined? I don't, you know, what does it mean?
He's going to tut very loudly.
He's going to tut and tell us how very disappointed he is. I mean, it's not, you know, it doesn't add up to a policy, really, does it?
This all must look a bit odd to you, Jeff, from the States, where anything goes.
Exactly. And so I wonder why someone doesn't just start their own Fox News on the internet, and there you go.
Well, Fox News is on British television.
Yeah, nobody watches it.
It's on satellite. It's in a number of millions of homes, and nobody watches it.
I was going to move on to something that's almost related to government, and I'm going to come to you, John Plunkett, because this is your bailiwick. Who will take over from Jenny Bramski at the BBC, which also often feels like a government department, as she was their director of audio and music, of course. And we mentioned this when you were last on before, but things have moved on a bit.
That's right, yes. We're down to a three-horse race.
Talking about horses and stable
horses,
doors.
Yes, they're still in the stables, are they? But the top door's open.
Shells.
We haven't got the sound effects. Anyway, carry on.
So we're down to Roger Mosey. This is what we hear,
right?
At least. Roger Mosey, Director of Sport, Radio 1 controller and controller of Asian Network and controller of One Extra and controller of BBC
This is all
Switch.
One person?
This is one person, Andy Parfitt.
Yeah.
The third person is Tim Davey, who's perhaps the who you'd imagine would be the outsider, being
the marketing man. Yes.
Not a huge amount of radio experience.
There is of course a tradition for appointing marketing gurus to senior positions in British broadcasting, isn't there?
It helps, yeah. Well, Andy Duncan and Matthew Bannister, but Matthew Bannister clearly had a radio background too. So, and again, word has it that Parfitt was the only controller to apply for the job, so we're told. Right. So which means that...
So how can Roger Moses in the running, then, if he didn't apply? I thought this was supposed to be a new open procedure at the BBC these days, where you apply for jobs. You don't get, you know, shooed into them.
Is that what you have to do?
Yeah, I think so. It's boring, isn't it?
If only I'd known, with Ashley's job on the table. Sorry, go on.
Go on.
Parfit got his 26-page CV out, yes. yes. Well, I think the implication was that neither Mark Demazor, again, as we understand, Mark Demazor and Leslie Douglas didn't apply. That was the implication.
Right.
But again, all what we hear, I hasten to add. So I imagine Parfit might be. I mean, he is 50 years old now, which, as we said before, is quite old to be running a radio station aimed at 16 to 24-year-olds. Yes. Not that I'm in any way ageist.
So he looks very good on it.
He does. He looks the youngest of the three candidates.
Yeah. He certainly does. Well, I think he's got all his hair, for a start. Yeah. Yes. Well, I don't know about Tim Davey. I can't picture Tim Davey.
I'm afraid I can't picture Tim Davey.
I know Tim Davey quite well.
Does he have all his hair?
Yes. He's tall and he's a nice-looking young man. And he has all his hair. He's very enthusiastic. He's very switched on.
Does he know anything about radio?
He apparently does spend quite a lot of time in radio saying how much he likes it and listens to it. I would be absolutely staggered if they gave it to him. Can I prejudge that in a sort of a...
No, of course you can.
Because, as I say, I think he's probably a great head of marketing for the BBC. But, you know, if you're head of radio, you are kind of in charge of quite a lot of the news output. You know, I mean, there is this thing about... You know, there was a question mark over whether Andy Parfit had a sufficiently serious news background to be able to deal with the various issues that arose. Because, of course, you know, Jenny Abramsky, absolutely sort of, impeccable credentials in that area. To have somebody with no content creation background at all in that job, you know, Jonathan Ross swearing at 10 o'clock in the morning, you know, it's a big ask. And I'm sort of quite surprised, but he's being talked up, I understand.
People within the corporation.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
perhaps they ought to run it like the final of The Apprentice and get them.
I think it's a bad signal as well. I'm sorry to say this. I think it's a bad signal if you say, in order to run a department like that, the BBC, you know, we're going to put it in the hands of someone who's really not spent a minute with their hands on the controls of the radio station. It does seem a bit odd to me.
And it's not as if BBC Radio needs a big kind of marketing push. They're doing quite a good job of that.
Well, I was going to say, the other thing is, how dominant do they want to be? Yeah. I mean,
maybe that's it. Maybe they're trying to decrease the share.
Somebody to make sure that it's kind of, you know, channeled into public service, and how are they going to kind of get over the embarrassment of completely killing the commercial radio sector?
Thank you very much. Enough of all this politicking. Time for some salacious celebrity gossip. Actually, hold on about 30 seconds for that. I have a public service announcement. Have you been working in TV for 2 to 4 years? Are you full of ideas, passion and drive? Then sign up for Fast Track and gain access to some of the most respected programme and policy makers in the business. This is our public service announcement for Fast Track. That's the young people's arm. Actually, you're not allowed to call it the young people's arm. You can be an old person, and so long as you've worked 2 to 4 years in television, that's okay. It's Fast Track, part of the Media Guardian Edinburgh International Television Festival, and if you're interested in signing up for that, you go to ngeitf.co.uk/fasttrack. Now then, onto the tittle tattle.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on guardian.co.uk.
I think I speak for everyone in the pod, or at least their inboxes, when I say that the Pop Bitch newsletter is one of the highlights of the email week. In its look and tone, the Wicked Whispers mailout hasn't changed much since it started 8.5 years ago, and it now has 350,000 subscribers. Media Talk's producer Ben Green spoke to Camilla Wright, the founder of Pop Bitch, to find out if everyone in the public eye is fair game for the likes of Heat, Holy Moly, and indeed her own website.
Well, we actually ran a Lay Off Britney story last September because it just seemed that she was being criticised in the press at the time for not putting her pram away right, and she was obviously looking in terrible state of either distress or inebriation at the time. So we did a Lay Off Britney. It's time we all kind of gave her rest. It's time for her to go away. So I was really pleased to see other websites doing the same. I think it's quite important. I think everybody's fair game as long as they look like they're in control of what they're doing. When you start to run stories on somebody's mental illness or their breakdown or maybe their relationship with their children, then it goes possibly crosses a line that we should all think about whether we want to cross.
If, say, the first stage of celebrity was, let's say, Diana, we're all very fawning and we're all very respectful. The second age of celebrity is seeing Kerry Katona with sweaty armpits and Lindsay Lohan with no pants on. What do you think the third age might be?
I think they've still got further down to go, I think, before anything changes. I think people are questioning why they like celebrities who are famous for being famous. But I think people actively like just looking at what somebody's life is like, especially if their life's like a bit of a car crash like Kerry Katona. And therefore, I think there'll be while there are people willing to put their lives up for this kind of scrutiny and do things that most people would not think of as public activities, the world of celebrity's got a long way to travel.
Well, it's certainly got a long way to travel. If you start at the armpits and work, then go down to the pants, and there's going to be a third age, what are we all going to be really excited about people's ankles next?
Yes, toes.
Back to Victorian times. Yeah. The lady's ankle.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. Now, of course, the big site in the US is Paris Hilton. And, I mean, you know, if we all get het up a bit about Popbitch and isn't it, oh, God, isn't it awful? But, I mean, you look at Paris Hilton and it's you know, nothing.
Yeah.
And now we were linked to Emily. The Guardian was linked to by Paris Hilton.
Not for anybody not wearing pants. John Plunkett. It was a small. It was a picture of a tiny baby polar bear.
Well, we were putting polar bear pictures up.
No, it was a video.
Oh, right.
And it was a proper zoological story.
I see.
As brought to us by Reuters. It was all very. It was high quality journalism. And Paris Hilton.
We weren't linked.
And we practically brought the site down. We had so much traffic on it.
All right. Well, there we go. You can listen to the whole of that talk. That it was is another one of our. That how much future of journalism is there? God, Jeff,
you're not there yet. That's the problem.
God, so much talking about it. Can we not just actually do it?
Just go and do it. That's right. Yeah. Shut up.
Dear Lord. Anyway, there's loads of, if you're a media studies student, you could write, there's endless essay material
there. Do you know what? I think we should be paid by the rest of the bloody industry. The stuff that we've put up on the website has been of such high quality. People like Jeff Jarvis. Do you know, somebody in the audience last night said to me, is that Jeff Jarvis there? And I said, yes. And they went, oh, in person. Him, Ariana, they said, they're everywhere, these web celebs.
He's
and
older than I thought, she said.
He's taller as well.
No, she said he just looks very. Oh, I think she was quite taken with you, Jeff.
Goodness me!
It's up all over the website, and you get incredibly insightful stuff. It's very exciting. In fact, I think we should only do the future of journalism in the future.
I think that's probably so quite sensible. I have a bit of gossip. We were talking last. There's nobody here who was on podcast last week, but last week we were talking about voiceovers because we've been doing some comedy voices, which we really shouldn't do. We're not going to do any more of those. Well, apart from Gareth McLean coming on soon, he's got a comedy voice. Comedy accent, and we were talking. We mentioned the guy who does the voice, who did the voice of Jerry Adams on television.
Oh.
Right? We mentioned him because
we were talking
about voiceovers.
What is it? 20 years.
Well, no, I found out that someone I've been in email contact with about a conference that I'm attending in Northern Ireland shares an office with the guy who does the voiceovers for Jerry Adams. He still exists.
That is a brilliant piece of gossip. Can we get him to voice some, you know, Good Week Bagwig? Can we bring back Good Week Bagwig and Badwick just to get him to voice
it? Voiced by
the
man who used to do Jerry Adams. That's a fantastic idea. Well, we'll do that. I'll arrange that for next week. And I mentioned Gareth McLean, and he's next. We've had to rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic in order to allow Gareth McKay. We haven't got enough chairs.
And lovely Jeff Jarvis has given me his.
That's nice. He's standing up
there. I thought it was Martin Jarvis, and I was going to get a rendition of a Just Williams story, but never mind. very nice. Hello.
How are you, Gal?
I'm very well, thanks. I've hot-footed it upstairs from watching episode 12 of Doctor Who.
Have you?
So the fate of the Earth is hanging in its balance, paused on my screen. Is downstairs.
You haven't watched the end?
No. I'm 38 minutes in.
Well. You mustn't reveal any.
It's not the very last episode. It's the second last.
Is it a double bill?
It's sort of a triple bill because I've watched episode 11 and it was quite exciting.
Have we seen that?
No, that's on Saturday.
God, it's all getting very confusing. Are you watching all of this, Emily?
No, I'm watching my children hover in the corridor while it's on telly, going, you know, oh, is it too scary? Is it too scary?
Say that they've pulled out all the stops for episode 12 is an understatement.
Oh, well, it's been
there's a whiff in the, you know, that bit at the beginning where the names come up.
Yeah.
They're really fast because there's so many. So there's a whiff and an and. And probably as well as.
And featuring. And introducing.
Introducing, guest starring.
What else have I got, Rinda? I can't read my own writing. Big, what's that saying?
Is it brother?
I don't know. It could be anything with you.
Yes.
That conference you're going to in Belfast, it's not put your clothes in a bin bag by the door, is it? One of those conferences
most
you
not.
Go to.
It's Big Brother that I wrote down because Alexandra's been kicked out.
Big bully.
Well, because she was threatening to shoot the other contestants, which I think is...
And their families.
I think, bring it on.
Is that against the rules?
I'm sure Endemol have probably secured the rights to that format and have already sold it around the world.
But they called her into the diary room for a mild admonition, didn't they?
An admonition.
But she's like, what do you,
is that so, like a brisk rubdown?
What do you think of this series? It's a tawdry fag end of a programme.
Well, it's kind of, I think,
you know, you would think their concern was genuine if you didn't think that they were a bunch of cynical buggers yes. who were just desperate for any sort of publicity that they could muster. But yeah, so no, bad Alex.
Yeah.
John for a weeping.
It's all of Big Brother.
Well, they've got another year of it, haven't they?
I was looking at Emily.
I just got that vacant stare. The Big Brother gives a vacant stare. Look. No, I don't think so. It'll dribble on for years.
It's the 10th birthday next year, isn't it?
Oh, we should crack open the champagne then.
Yes.
I am watching it, I'm afraid.
Are you?
And my 10-year-old's recording but I,
there's
watching
too, there's
it
too much
10-year-old? I'm a bad parent.
You are.
Hello, Podders. Really this is producer Ben, and I've got a public service announcement of my own. As you know, if Media Talk were an hour or massage, this part with Gareth McLean would be the happy finish. He was, as always, on tip-top form this week, extremely bawdy, and made Matt and the rest of the panel giggle. A lot. Jeff Jarvis was particularly amused, I noticed, from the control room. Or was that bemused? Who knows? Anyway, as you probably noticed from that minute or so that you've just heard, all semblance of pod discipline disappeared very rapidly indeed, and this cutting-edge media chat podcast with some occasional swear words descended into Matt Wells and friends talk over each other and laugh at a series of running gags that are very difficult to edit down. Hilarious to everyone in the pod, but pretty piss poor to listen to, I'm afraid. So what you're not now hearing is, to borrow from Simon Mayo and Mark Commode, some wittertainment and searing insight about BBC Three Summer Heights High, how Guardian.co.uk has fallen behind the Mail and the Telegraph in the online ratings, something about phlegm, not sure why, Silverjet Airlines business model, John Plunkett's story about playing poker with Raj Pasood, and Gareth looking forward to seeing Grace Jones in concert, supported, of course, by Fern Britton's gastric band. There's one good edit point, it's about to come up. A normal service, I promise, will be resumed next week. Bye!
Do you think we'll have to wait and see if Ben, producer Ben, can go and weave something of consequence out of this?
Is it time for a silk purse out of the sow's ear?
Has no one else had a biscuit, by the way?
No, because last week we started eating the biscuits before the programme, and then people noticed that we had crumbs in our throat.
It looked to me like someone might have been fingering the jammy dodgers.
Oh, I love it. Keep your finger jammy rings to yourself.
That'll have been Gareth McLean. Thank you very much. Thank you very much to John Plunkett, Gareth McLean, Emily Bell, and our special guest flown in at great expense.
Was it?
We'll talk about the future of journalism.
Yeah, Jeff Jarvis. Jeff Jarvis, Gareth McLean, Emily Bell, thank you very much. I'm Matt Wells. See you again soon. Goodbye. We did all end up talking over each other.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.